Warning, this episode contains material that may be triggering and disturbing for some individuals. Please consider your mental health and well-being before listening. Thank you. When was the suicide ideation over, or is that something that you still struggle with?
It's something that will always be a part of my life, more than likely. And it's one of those where, so last November, I had another mental breakdown. It was the opposite of what happened in my 20s. Life was going great. And everything that I could ask for happening. I very much thought I was kind of over the hump of just what I had gone through mentally and in my personal life. And the opposite of distress is eustress. But the problem is the body, the brain, doesn't recognize the difference. Whether it's good or bad stress, it reads it as stress. And I reached a breaking point that I didn't even realize, because I'm on a, you know, living a high, right?
You are now listening to Unrelenting Humans podcast. My name is Lonnie. I am your host. And on this episode, we are talking to mental health advocate Gordon Corsetti. I really wanted to have this conversation with Gordon because he lives with depression. And right now, with COVID on the rise and the holidays and everything going on in this world, I know a lot of people are dealing with anxiety and feelings of worthlessness and suicide ideation. So I really felt it was important to have this conversation. If you know me and you listened to my episode earlier on, then you know that I live with bipolar depression. So this episode, having this conversation with Gordon, was very therapeutic for me. I think it's important when we feel these feelings and we're feeling low that we talk to people and we tell people how we're feeling and we seek treatment. So, along with this conversation in the notes, I will be leaving a link to Gordon's website and a few other websites for mental health in case, you know, you need help with depression or suicide ideation. I want you to have that. So I did put a disclaimer on this episode because there are a few details about Gordon's suicide attempts and I do not want to trigger anyone. So if you are easily triggered by that type of content, then I would suggest maybe not listening or listen with people. So without further ado, don't forget to like, subscribe, rate, follow us on Instagram at unrelenting_humans, and thank you for listening.
So I live in Roswell, Georgia. I am living at the moment in Tunnel Hill, Georgia, which is a little south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, while I am at trade school to become an electrical lineman.
Oh, nice.
That's so a good job. shifting industries for my own better happiness and health. So it's been quite an adventure. I got a couple more weeks left of the program, then hopefully I get picked up by a contractor in and around Atlanta.
Definitely. I'm sure you will. As you are a mental health advocate, you have went through your own bouts with depression. And right now, with COVID and people being not able to like work out at the gyms like they used to, well, over here at least. I don't know what's going on in Georgia, but in California, we're kind of shutting back down and it's winter's coming. So I'm sure depression is going to be on a rise. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, a little bit about how you got into speaking about depression.
Sure. Well, I have to agree with you. I'm not sure what the gym, the local gym up here is open. with some restrictions, if that gives you an indication. But yeah, things are a little different in the Southeast. But the I do think you're right. The current reporting on depression ranks, rates, anxiety rates is going up. And I think also just anecdotally, my sister deals with plenty of her stuff. I do. I got plenty of my friends, and even those who never battled with a diagnosable mental health condition or mental illness are, you know, they're calling me like, hey, what do you do? Because I'm the walls are closing in, and I haven't talked or actually like had physical contact with anybody in months, and this is driving me up the wall. I'm like, I get it. And you know, some of them had joked for me, they're just like, well, Gordon, you're an introvert anyway, so this whole lockdown scenario doesn't really affect you. And I'm like, I'm not that much of an introvert. I do like people, just small doses. But there is something to be said for the things that can be done, even on an individual basis within your own home, to increase your overall wellness. That may be physical, that may be mental. Things that can lower your stress threshold while it's being raised by everything else that's going on this year.
Yeah.
And especially now coming into the holidays, where people expect to be able to be with the people they care about. And if that may not be on the table this time around, that's added stress and added worry and angst. And it's a big recipe for just a whole host of painful issues to have to go through. And then say, like, you still have to work and take care of your kids and take care of yourself. It's just a lot.
Definitely. So, yeah. For me, I use fitness and sports as kind of my de-stressor. Mm-hmm. I use that to manage my depression. So not being able to really be as active is like,
it's you know, this summer was especially rough for me because you know, when the lockdown started kind of cascading at the middle of the spring, I was right in the middle of my lacrosse season, so I'm refereeing 3, 4, 5 times a week, you know, with double headers and whatnot, and traveling and working with my buddies and being outside and enjoying that. And then we just saw all these programs and leagues shutting their doors. And then it was just over one day in March. And I'm like, this is never happening. I called all my mentors, never happened to them. It was such a novel thing that we were all kind of in shock for a little while. And then I'm like, a month later, I'm like, I don't think I've actually left my apartment except to like go get groceries. This isn't good. And I didn't really have a good way of dealing with that. And I spent most of the summer in my apartment, minimal workouts, just trying to get by. And, but it was also as easy too, because it's like I freelance and or did at the time. And, so it's like, you know, I set my own schedule. It didn't matter if I woke up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, cause I went to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. It didn't, none of that really, factored in. Everybody's schedules got messed up. Mine did as well. And we're creatures of habit. We're creatures of rhythm. Not being able to do the things that we enjoy and being out of sync from the schedule that we've developed for ourselves is very unsettling.
Yeah, very much so. So as a lacrosse referee now, well, how did you get into that anyway?
So I'd been playing since about fifth grade. The family business was a youth lacrosse league. I came up in that and learned coaching and got introduced to refereeing at a very young age. But didn't really start getting into it for high school lacrosse or really the time where you're taking it seriously until a little bit after college. And I did that because while I enjoyed the sport of lacrosse, I didn't really enjoy it as a player. I had too many perfectionistic tendencies and way too much depression to really enjoy my high school and early college playing career before I decided to step away. When I found and tried out officiating as a way to remain connected with the game, I realized that paradoxically, everybody expects officials to start off perfect and get better from there. Or they just don't expect you to be very good at all. So it's like the playing field was really weird mentally, that I didn't have this weird pressure that I put on myself to be absolutely perfect because no one expected you to be. And so that helped, but it was just a way for me to, I didn't realize this until later, it was a way for me to be a calm force in the middle of this kind of wild, stressful game experience that everybody else is running high. Whereas mine, I need to maintain some relative stability.
Yeah, you're kind of neutral.
that's the best referee is. And over time, I realized that that mentality I cultivated over the years as a referee is also a very helpful one for me with my depression, my anxiety, my tendency towards suicidal ideation, how part of how my depression manifests. And it's one of those things where that mentality has helped me now off the field many, many times in my life. And it's one of the reasons I continue refereeing, because not only just do I enjoy it and I enjoy the people, but it's one of those things that, quite frankly, keeps me alive.
Yeah. When were you diagnosed as depressed?
Around 18 or 19. that was right in the middle of my freshman year of college, which is, interestingly enough, when a lot of reported cases of depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, and hospital admissions for suicide attempts go up, because people are moving to a new area, their kids are free for the first time, they can do whatever the heck they really want to do, and you're not really in the best. I don't know if you remember being an 18, but I certainly didn't make the best decisions in the world.
No, I definitely did not. I had my first kid at 18.
So. It's one of those, like, it's I talked all the time. It's just like our brains are still developing at that age, and we're still having to make these massive, far-reaching decisions, and we're just not equipped for it. And so you kind of got to roll with it. And
yeah, our brains aren't finished fusing until we're 25, and
yeah,
from there it's.
Yeah, that's why pretty much I refer to kids as everybody under 25. My coaching folks really get a kick out of that. But it is. And it's one of those of having to respect that fact when I talk to coaches about how they coach younger individuals. But at the time, I didn't know what the heck was going on. I just realized I was so stressed, I couldn't physically get out of bed for multiple days on end. Mm-hmm. And then it was a visit to an ER, and a doctor threw a medication at me, said, take this, you'll be okay. You probably have depression. But it wasn't until probably like a year after that I actually had a formal diagnosis from a therapist and psychiatrist. I've always had depression. I call myself a depressive. It's a term that I do prefer. I think it's a little bit more of a positive spin on it. But it's one of those things of I lost the genetic roll of the dice in that one, and it's something I have to constantly kind of be vigilant about and factor into my decision makings on a day-to-day basis, and as a, you know, what do I want my life to look like down the road.
So what was it like when they diagnosed you with the meds?
It was a weird thing, because it's at first I'm like, okay, I'll take these pills, and they're like, you're probably not going to feel anything for like 2 or 3 weeks. Like, they're probably not at all. Just take the pills. It's low. They always start on the lowest possible dose, called the lowest effective dose, and see if that does anything for you. And so I'm taking a pill every morning, and 2-3 weeks later go by. I'm walking from class to my dorm, and I remember this like it was yesterday. I stopped dead in my tracks, because I realized from call it like 15 to 19, so 4 years about, of these constant negative thoughts, this loop that was going on in my head of, you're worthless, you're terrible, nobody loves you, you're a burden, you should end your life, you should kill yourself.
Oh,
these things on a constant loop. That
while you're on the pills?
Not while I was on the pills. This was for the 4 years I was doing this, right? So
okay.
So untreated, right? The 4 years I was untreated. And then 2-3 weeks after starting an antidepressant, I'm walking across the quad, and suddenly that stops. And like, I put one foot down, realize my brain isn't firing these messages at me. And I couldn't believe it. It was this massive weight off my shoulders, but it was also just a really weird and lovely feeling too, because I'm like, whoa, this is what it's like to not have this stuff in my head. I can actually think about the things I'd like to think about. It was a wildly good experience. So for another 5-year period, it was a cycle of getting on antidepressants, cold turkeying them, hospital, going back on them, going off of them, suicide attempts, hospitals.
So
that was the... That's my warning story, and especially when I talk to, you know, parents and folks who are like, you know, should we put them on? I'm like, you should, if that's what the doctor and psychiatrist are recommending. And if you choose to go off of them, do it under their supervision because they'll do it correctly. And if something goes awry, they at least can help you out with that. Don't.
Right. No, I agree. That is important. Well, to do it on their supervision and not harm yourself anymore. Mm-hmm. So you said that you have this roller coaster basically with the going on and off of the meds and with suicide ideation and attempts. So is there a particular time or multiple times that you attempted suicide?
Twice when I was 23, and I call it once, but it was a multiple times over a 2-week period when I was about 24, 25. Hangings, overdose, and attempts with a handgun. So those were, what I had tried to do.
And what stopped you?
I get that question a good bit, and I've gotten that from a lot of friends, especially when I went public with my story a couple of years ago in La Crosse magazine. That's where I got into this advocacy work with what I do for a public speaking side and podcast things as well. You know, folks ask me all the time, kind of, you know, what stopped you from doing that? And for a little while, I couldn't give a great answer. And, you know, after kind of looking around it and what, you know, trying to remember my thought processes through all those attempts is, so I'm a perfectionist by nature, right? I've spent probably half of my therapy hours, and I've been in therapy for 15 years, probably just talking about perfectionism and how how I deal with that is not generally healthy and better ways to do it. But that led to, it's, you know, very much a double-edged sword. I planned out my suicide attempts to be lethal and to have nobody around. It was as risky of a thing to do. And at the same time, because I researched, and that's kind of how my brain goes, I knew the statistics behind these different methods that I had, you know, devised. And I knew that I didn't have a guarantee that what I was going to try to do was going to work. And there was a high likelihood that I was going to seriously injure myself and probably make my life even worse, which was it was something when I got to that point where I was either standing on the stool or when I had the gun in my mouth, I could not finish that action. And in that sense, I successfully failed at killing myself, which I'm happy about.
I like that.
I tell folks all the time that for a long time after those attempts, I was pissed off because I was like, I can't do this thing. And I thought to myself, I'm like, you know what? After a while it was, I don't suck at suicide. I succeed in living. That's how I eventually was able to reframe that. So that's where that is. It's heavy. So take a breather.
That's a good way. I like that. Yeah. Okay. What did you say exactly again? You said you were unsuccessful.
I successfully failed to kill myself.
Successfully failed. I love that. Okay. That's a good one. I love that. I love that way of looking at it because, I know we look at it and we think about suicide and then when people don't do it and we know a lot of people have different reasons of why they don't go through with it or what stopped them, like maybe a phone call or they thought about their kids or their dog needed to eat or something. But I don't think I've ever asked anybody that question and I've definitely never got that answer. So I like that. So... when was the suicide ideation over? Or is that something that you still struggle with?
It's something that will always be a part of my life, more than likely. And it's one of those where, so last November, I had another mental breakdown. It was the opposite of what happened in my 20s. Life was going great. And everything that I could ask for happening, I very much thought I was kind of over the hump of just what I had gone through mentally and in my personal life. And the opposite of distress is eustress. But the problem is the body, the brain doesn't recognize the difference. Whether it's good or bad stress, it reads it as stress. And I reached a breaking point that I didn't even realize, because I'm on a, you know, living a high, right? And I wind up at Emory in their psychiatric facility there for about 2 weeks, while the doctors there are like, well, you've tried several different antidepressants and antipsychotics and several combinations of these, and they work for a time, but clearly there's they call it treatment resistant depression, right? So they said, we'd like you to try electroconvulsive therapy. It's called ECT for short. And I said, well, let go. All right. You know, I had nothing better to do. I was locked in a psych ward. So, you know, they were going to give me drugs to knock me out, and I couldn't sleep anyway. So it's like, why not go for it? And the ECT very much, I wasn't really sure if it was going to actually do anything, but it's got about an 80% efficacy rate for most of the population. And after about 10 sessions,
so what exactly is it supposed to do?
Right.
Because I'm just imagining you shocking electricity.
Basically,
in your body,
so I mean, like, yeah, when you get down to it, sure, it's a little like me and you're I'm joking on that part. So electroconvulsive therapy, despite as it's been portrayed in movies in the past as a very safe medical procedure, it's got a lot of checks and balances in it. But effectively what it is now is you're given muscle relaxants and you're put under general anesthesia, which will last for about 15 to 20 minutes. It's not a long procedure or amount of time under. And with one or two kind of paddles, they pass voltage across your temples through your brain, and they induce a seizure anywhere from about a minute to 90 seconds. The muscle relaxants make it so that your body's not flailing all over the place and they don't need restraints or anything like that. But you don't feel any of this. You're totally out. And then you get wheeled into the recovery room, and you wake up and a nurse gives you orange juice and a cookie, and you kind of are good on that front. But the, like much of what we, of how we treat mental illnesses now, is very much we kind of know how this works, but not really. We just know that it works for some people some of the time, so we're keeping doing what we're doing. So they don't know the exact mechanism as to why ECT is so effective, especially getting people out of a crushing depression so rapidly, why it's so effective at reducing suicidal thoughts, which I've been grateful they have got far away from me, and much less frequent and less intense, which I'm grateful for now. And the current theory right now, as I'm chatting with the doctors as they're doing all their procedures and whatnot, is that it gives a chance to, it basically floods that seizure, floods the brain with neurotransmitters, and also then allows the brain to kind of reset itself and it allows it to think more efficiently. So after about 10 to 12 sessions of this, you do it at least, you do it about three times a week, and then they start weaning you off a few times a week. About 80% of the people will start seeing some type of therapeutic benefit. And I was one of the ones that he was like, you have very robust seizures. And I'm like, great. I didn't have anything to do with that, but if it helps me out, cool. So that was my last kind of really significant treatment for my depression, for my suicidal thoughts. And it turned out to be remarkably effective for me. And one of the things that I'm grateful, I live in Georgia, and I've got Emory down the road if I need future treatments.
Yeah. So would you suggest that for anybody who has been, you know, I guess struggling lifelong with depression and hasn't had success with, you know,
traditional medication, psychotherapy? Sure. It's one of those where, again, this is a talk to your psychiatrist and doctor conversation.
Yeah.
I'm a convert to the procedure. And it's also one of the things that it's not always effective, or it's not always as effective as I was lucky enough to have. So I say I speak about it, and answer questions about it, because it's one of those things I wish I could have done 10 years ago. I believe it would have saved me a lot of pain, would have saved my family a lot of pain. And I'd be in a really a better spot in life now, even though I'm enjoying life as it is right now. I would have saved myself a lot of grief if I had been introduced to this procedure earlier. And I, yeah. So I talk about that. I talk about TMS, which is transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's a different version. And then they also do a procedure with ketamine. So all these things where if one doesn't really work for somebody, another one may have more likelihood to have a therapeutic effect.
I wanted to ask about something that you had mentioned that you had coached an adaptive lacrosse.
Yes. Yeah.
That sounds so dope. Can you explain to us what that like was like and what?
Sure. So my dad's a longtime coach, and so I learned to coach primarily from him. I came to Georgia because closer to my mom and dad, my sister. And I had a weekend off from the school I'm going to, and he said, hey, you know, I'm doing this wheelchair lacrosse, adaptive lacrosse thing for a local rec program. There's a company called Blaze Sports. They do different, you know, wheelchair rugby, basketball. And I'm like, yeah, sure, absolutely. And so we went down to some local tennis courts. They had temperature checks and full COVID protocols. We're all keeping our distance, which is fine with lacrosse. You don't really need to get close to people for passing and catching.
Yeah.
But we spent 2 hours on the tennis courts with about 10 10 mix of middle schoolers, high schoolers, and I think like one like freshman year of college individual. And we ran them through how to cradle, how to pick up ground balls, how to pass and catch, how to dodge, how to shoot. And then at the very end of it, we did, it's something that we did with little kids. We do kids versus coaches, which is always kind of fun. But to kind of level the playing field, the coaches had to play with their stick behind their back the entire time. So you're, we call it Australian lacrosse. So you're doing it upside down, right? So all the coaches are doing this and these kids are in the, so we played for about 20 minutes and I was gassed by the end of it. There was this one guy named Noah who was just all over me the entire time and stripped me a few times. Those kids could move and they were having a blast. And by the end of it, I was drenched in sweat and there were a lot of smiles. And it was just definitely probably one of the highlights of my lacrosse just journey, so to speak, not even just coaching journey. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. I would love to see that.
No worries.
Sorry. So we also had talked a little bit about how coaches ask you for advice about their players that may be showing symptoms of depression. And do you have any stories that might stand out other than among others?
I think it's interesting when I start doing, typically these conversations come out of coaching workshops that I do, which is now all virtual, obviously, on that end. But before COVID, I did a couple of lacrosse and coaching conferences, and I'm speaking to a group of folks and just trying to get a sense in the room of just like, who feels like all of your kids are just wound up tighter than a freaking spring and every hand goes in the air? I'm like, does anyone know how to deal with that? And one guy was just like, I feel as much like a school counselor as I do a coach. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah. I'm glad you're in the room because we're going to give you some options on this. And you know, there's probably still the biggest thing, and it feels like an obvious statement to make, but it's one that you get lost of when you're in the nitty gritty of coaching high schoolers, youth athletes, even some degree to college folks, of kids are not adults. And you can't coach to them. You can't relate to them as you would another adult or as you would to yourself. It doesn't, there's a line of communication that just isn't there when you maintain that mindset that you're speaking to somebody who gets adult problems. Right. And that doesn't mean I minimize the problems of youth. Not at all. I hold them up as champions because it's, you know, when I speak to high school kids, I'm like, I applaud you all for even getting to school today because this is a mess that you all live in. And on top of the fact that like you have to do this, there's no option. Like if I want to go move somewhere, I do. You guys are stuck doing what you're doing. So kudos on that. But a lot of what I speak to coaches about is they're like, well, how can I see, you know, how can I better speak to students, to the student athletes that I have or whatnot? And probably one of the ones and one of the more impactful techniques, I'll give you two of them that I do here is, one is from years of therapy, which is when you have to challenge a player who says something negative about themselves that you overhear. So one of them may be, you know, in a lacrosse situation, they miss a pass and like, I suck at passing. Like, okay, stop, time out, let's have a conversation. All right, now what did you just say? Mm-hmm. I suck at passing. I was like, okay, would you say that same statement to your best friend or to your teammate? And the answer is always no, not at all. That's my teammate, right? And it's like, so if it's not okay to say it to your teammate, why is it okay for you to say that to yourself? So that's one bit. And it's like, and that's not the end of the conversation. That's just a time for the coach to pause and allow that kid to process what that really means for them. And that then starts an opportunity for that coach to help that player kind of replace what's going on. It's like, yeah, you may have made a bad pass. That does not mean you are a bad passer all the time, right? So it's being, language has power. And so it's helping that kid become intentional with how he or she is saying things to themselves. Because as you know, right. As I know, as you get older, you realize that unfortunately you can never walk away from yourself. You're always there. And you got to be able to deal with that.
Right. And self-talk is really important. It's really the thin line between having a good day and a bad day. It's really your perspective and how you talk to yourself, because that is the person you have to go home to every night or look in the mirror.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the other technique I give, I've got a video of this up on my website at mentallyagile.com, where the technique I do is called cartoon voice replacement. Okay. So I'll ask you, I'll pretend like you're in the audience for me here. And I say, okay, I'd like you, Lonnie, to imagine the person that aggravates you the most in life. Got that person?
Okay.
Like you hear that person's voice and
does it have to
no,
be
not it it's something that speaks. It's got to be something that speaks.
Okay, my cat aggravates me the most.
I can relate to that. I've got a little kid who likes to teeth. But so I'm talking about that, yeah. But this also may work because you said that you live with depression as well, correct? Right. So, as I say to this end, it's like, I don't have to worry about like somebody else aggravating me. It's my internal monologue that can aggravate me, that can throw me off my piece at any given moment if I allow it to. And this is a technique that I borrow from conflict de-escalation. It's called cartoon voice replacement. So the idea here, whether it's another person saying something at you or you're imagining a conversation with that person and you're already getting a little antsy and nervous about it, or if it's your own internal thoughts and you're hearing it in your own voice, makes it very difficult to argue against that voice, right? Very, very, very hard to argue with ourselves and come out the winner. So you replace it with a cartoon character that speaks. And my personal favorite is Elmer Fudd. So when I talk to folks, it's and I'll do this in the classroom, I'm like, you are a terrible person. You are horrible. You are a horrible wefawee. And everybody laughs and I crack up and I go, everybody see how easy it was to laugh at that? Because I took something that the statement itself was absurd, but when it's yelled at by an angry coach or a pissed off person that you rear-ended in the grocery store, a parking lot, or your own internal voice, the manner in which it's being said doesn't allow you to find the funny ridiculousness in it. So I say, make the absurd statement sound as absurd as it is by replacing that voice with your favorite cartoon character. And I say that works for little kids, works for adults on that. But I do find that it turns that especially for young players, into another game. That's a game they can learn to play with themselves with negative talk on the field or on the court, but also when they get off the field or off the court and they do it at home. That's something that if they could learn to develop that at a younger age, that only gets stronger with time.
Yeah, No, I like that. I really do. I like that. I'm going to implement that and share that. I do have to get going, though. I really enjoyed this conversation. I would love to talk to you more.
Oh, I'm sure.
If that's possible.
I'm sure we can find something.
Schedule something. All right. Well, it has been a great pleasure, Gordon. Do you have any social media that you want to share?
Yes. So again, my website is mentallyagile.com. All my contact information is on there, and you can find me on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter if you just search Mentally Agile or Mental Agility. And I'm also on LinkedIn just as Gordon Corsetti. But if you just go to my website, you'll find all my stuff. I'm more than happy to get in touch with anybody who has questions or has ideas for future topics for me to consider.
That was a great interview with Gordon. Like I said, it was very therapeutic for me to talk to him. And I wanted to add a few things about suicide ideation, more or less, because we really don't recognize the signs in people. I mean, when we think about it, we think of someone saying they're going to commit suicide, but it's not always like that. I mean, actually, it's probably never like that. No one really advertises it. So a lot of people feel it, though. And what suicide ideation is, or signs of it, is feelings of appearing to be trapped or hopeless, feeling intolerable for emotional pain, being preoccupied with violence, dying, or death, having mood shifts, either happy or sad, talking about revenge, guilt, or shame, experiencing agitation or heightened state of anxiety, experiencing changes in personality, routine, or sleep patterns, increasing the use of drugs or alcohol, engaging in risky behavior such as driving carelessly, taking drugs, or maybe being more promiscuous, getting their affairs in order and giving things away, getting a hold of a gun or substances that could end life, where that is different type of pills and alcohol, mixing them, isolating themselves, talking about being a burden to others. Those are things you have to really look for. Experiencing psychomotor agitation such as pacing or wringing the hands, saying goodbye to others as though it were the last time. Experience a loss of enjoyment in previously pleasurable activities such as eating, exercise, social interaction, or sex, experiencing severe remorse or self-criticism, talking about suicide or dying, or they might be vague and say stuff like, I don't want to be here, or I hate this life, or anything along those lines, like, I can't wait to die. So you have to be careful with those. Expressing regret about being alive or ever being born. So a significant number of people with suicide ideation keep their thoughts and feelings a secret, so it's not that easy. And there's like no real signs, but you really have to pay attention to the small details and, you know, check on them in yourself as well. Like, this is a really hard time that we live in, and sometimes the bills are piling up, people aren't working, it gets really tough. And some people may have the opposite, they might be, you know, thriving right now, but a lot of people aren't. So I just want you guys to have that information, and that, just keep that in mind. Check on your friends. Have a real conversation. If you haven't heard from somebody or seen them online, give them a call. Go by their house. Send them some flowers. Anything. You never know. You might save a life. So thank you all for listening. Anybody that has listened this far, you are the real MVPs. I love you. Thank you for your support. I will be back. See you next week.